I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to Chinchilla Squeaks with me, Christian Scheller. Getting towards the end of the year, probably the last episode or two of 2023. It's been quite a busy year. I'll do a little bit of a recap, I think, in the next and final episode for the year. But today I'm actually going back nearly 6 months now, wow, to catch up with two of the final interviews recorded at and around We Are Developers here in Berlin in summer. First, I speak with Philipp Rick and his love of Cypress, the automation testing framework that's popular with many. And then I speak with Denny Leclerc about accessibility, but specifically accessibility for vision in websites and on the web. So let's jump into those after a few.
At Grainger, we're for the ones who specialize in saving the day and for the ones who've mastered the art of keeping business moving. We offer industrial-grade supplies for every industry with same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders, all backed by real people ready to help, so you can get the right answers and products right when you need them. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Words from sponsors.
So, Philipp, you are seemingly very excited about Cypress. I'm not talking about the country, I'm talking about, well, tell us, what is Cypress?
Well, Cypress is a test automation tool for anything that runs inside the browser. So mostly web applications, but you can do some more fun stuff about it. And recently, it's still things running in a browser, but recently Cypress has expanded its functionality to not only do end-to-end testing, but also component testing. Mm-hmm. So you can take your component from any framework that you use, mount it inside the browser, run tests on it, and then like debug it very, very comfortably, because it's like there with your dev tools and every tool you need.
It still has to be in the browser. You can't do native mobile.
No, not really. But I have seen a solution for like React Native apps. So you could like mount those inside like the React parts. You could mount in browser and test those.
You could do something similar with languages like Flutter.
Probably. I haven't really experimented with that. But yeah, I think that could be doable.
Yeah. And Cypress, I think a lot of people might know tools like Selenium. And mm-hmm. As far as I remember, Cypress has some of the team maybe bought off from it, or there's a connection between the two, I think.
I think there is actually, I would say maybe the opposite, like there is a disconnect. because the way I like to explain the basic difference between Selenium and Cypress is that Selenium uses WebDriver protocol to mm-hmm. basically automate the browser, right? And Cypress chose a slightly different approach. Instead of using the WebDriver protocol to automate the browser, it injects itself right inside the browser and automates your app directly. So you could imagine it like, you know, Selenium tries to ring the doorbell, Cypress is kind of already inside the door, which means that there you will get a hard time to do some stuff, you know, like outside the house, but you get closer to what you are actually testing. And I think that's a big advantage, but of course it's a design decision they made, and it brings you some advantages, and of course it brings you some limitations.
Mm-hmm. And which one came first? I think it's still Selenium.
Yeah, Selenium came first. Yeah.
As far as I'm aware, Cypress has become kind of the cooler option, or at least the more popular option recently, especially in the JavaScript world.
Yeah, it definitely has an appeal, and I think that appeal was built by how well it fits the developer workflow. So if you're a web developer, you are already familiar with, you know, React, Angular, Vue.js, whatever. You build those tools, you work inside the browser, you have a live dev server, so anything you change in a file gets reload it. You get to work with CLI, run your tests on GitHub Actions and whatnot. And Cypress is exactly that. Cypress has this runner, which you can open, and it essentially opens the browser. And you can run your test. Whenever you save them, they automatically rerun. The CI integration is quite seamless. So I think that workflow, fitting into that workflow, is what made Cypress really popular, especially among developers. But yeah, testers and QA engineers have been implementing that quite a lot as well. It brought some challenges. It brought some happiness to testing. But yeah, we could talk about that a little more, about how Cypress has affected the testing world.
Okay. Why not? You've dropped a hint there. Why don't we go for it?
I mean, yeah, we could jump right into it. I think that what I like to say is that Cypress kind of brought testers closer to development and developers closer to testing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a developer and you're supposed to be writing tests, you're not very enthusiastic about it. You want to get the job done as fast as you can. And I think Cypress has helped a lot with that, because it has like very, very simple API, very simple commands that allow you to write your tests in a matter of seconds, right? And I think that was also a great appeal for testers, because the simplicity of the syntax was meant that many of the people that wanted to enter the test automation field had a lot lower barrier, you know? But as I mentioned, it brought testers closer to web development. So I think maybe Selenium was maybe more forgiving if your approach to testing was sort of like a black box testing.
Yeah.
You want to do automation, and you're not really considered too much about what is happening inside your app. Cypress is less forgiving in that way. I think it sort of invites you to examine what's happening inside. And one good example of that is that Cypress has this like really cool intercept command that essentially catches any kind of HTTP requests going from your front end to your server. And you can work with those. You can even mock those. You can wait for them to finish and make your tests more stable with that. And there are like endless options with what you can do just with the network layer that sometimes you kind of need to do that. And that's the aspect that sort of invites you to understand what's actually going on with that application. And I've been really enjoying that. But I've seen that not always sit well with everyone.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say unless you are ready, unless you want to enter that world to learn a little bit more about web development, maybe it's better to stick with some other tools. But for me, I think it's a huge advantage to be able to do that. So I would recommend that personally.
Just out of interest, we spoke a minute ago about how they're both primarily aimed at testing, but the aspect of automation did let some people do some other interesting things.
Yeah.
And we talked about automating screenshots and things. So would you say that Selenium was better for those kind of cases, or can people still do those automation things that are not really directly related to testing with Cypress?
Yeah, I think if you take a look at the homepage of both these tools, you'll get some hints there, right? If you go to Selenium, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but it says Selenium automates browsers.
Okay, yeah.
And like what you do with that power is totally up to you, right? So yeah, you could do more like web scraping, some scripts for yourself, create your workflows for that, I guess. With Cypress, I actually forgot what the homepage says, but it is a testing tool.
Yeah.
It has to be a test. It actually has this binary kind of setup where your test either passes or fails. There's nothing in between. There's no like...
It just ran.
Yeah, something just ran. It either passes or fails.
Yeah, okay. And why did you get into it in the first place?
Well, I kind of got lucky, I would say, because I entered the tech world about 7 years ago, maybe eight, I don't know. And at that time I was working with Slido and I was just starting to test and I knew that there is something called test automation. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I had to do some in order to be able to keep up pace with our development, right? And at that time I played with Selenium IDE.
Oh yeah.
Which was a nice tool, but I like didn't know what I was doing. And funnily enough, Cypress had like their first ever presentation. I think it was first ever in Bratislava at a React conference, ReactConf, something like that. I forgot the name. And my colleagues came back from that conference and said, hey, this is a cool tool. Maybe you should check it out. And at that time, it was like invite only.
Yeah.
So I got my invite. And the rest is history, you know, like the API was very easy to grasp. The documentation was stellar from day one, actually. It was really good. And I just started working with Cypress and I didn't like think much of it. I didn't like think about, hey, I should really decide which tool I need to use, examine all the different possibilities and pick the best one. I chose Cypress, it worked well for me, and I didn't even consider myself to be like questioning that decision. So
yeah.
in a way, I got quite lucky.
And now you're an official or unofficial kind of evangelist for the project? Or?
Yeah, there's an ambassador program with Cypress, which I entered basically at the beginning, like when Cypress decided to create this ambassador program, I was already in. That was lovely. And yeah, and after that, I realized, hey, this Cypress ambassadorship is kind of a cool thing. Maybe I could do something with that. And my colleague in work said, like, you could already teach it. And I was like, I could teach that? I'm in the tech world for like 2 days, right? I don't feel like teaching anything, but he gave me the confidence that I can. So I decided to write some blog posts, then I went to a conference, did a workshop, and then I started to do those workshops on my own. It's been like a really, really fun journey.
And what is the setup of Cypress itself? Is it fully open source, or is there a company behind it, or a commercial version and a free version?
Yeah, this is the part that confuses some people, so I'm really glad you brought that up. Cypress is completely open source.
Okay.
It's a tool you can use for free. There is a Cypress company, right? And that company hired a lot of people, and what they are building is Cypress Cloud, formerly known as Cypress Dashboard. So what this enables you to do is to easily create a parallelization for your tests. And as we speak there, they are bringing some new features like test replay, so you can actually debug your test. That's going to be like really cool. And that part of the product is paid. The part that confuses people is that they say, oh, you cannot run Cypress in parallel if you don't pay. You actually can, but the catch is you need to build that on your own.
Yeah, for sure.
So that takes a little bit of time, and you need to build that on your own with many different tools, right, as well. But it's not like they don't allow it. It's just like
normal open source.
Yeah.
If you can figure it out. So not wanting to take away from you running workshops and things, but what would be the number one thing you would say to someone who wants to learn Cypress that might be the thing that usually confuses people?
What would be the number one thing that confuses people? I actually talk about this in my workshop. Cypress has this chaining syntax where each command passes information onto another,
mm-hmm.
which is a design pattern which I feel like really plays well with what the test should be. Like test ideally shouldn't have like conditions, if else. It's promise-like, but essentially what you are creating in your test is a scenario that starts at point A and finishes at point Z, right? And it kind of forces you to be very linear with your tests. And the confusion usually starts when you want to open your application, and then let's say a list renders out, and you want to take the first item, and there's an ID, and you want to save that ID for later in your test. Now, the question is whether that is a good design, right? Because if you, the source of truth comes from the application itself, it's sort of questionable if that's a good design of your test, because there may be an error in your application, your test will pass. And because it was basing information on that, right? It's not impossible to do in Cypress, it's not as intuitive as declaring a variable and assigning a value. You need to, when you have something dynamic in your test, you need to make it part of that chain of commands. So that's something that usually confuses people.
I think I see what you mean about bringing testers and developers sort of closer together.
Yeah.
All right, if people want to find out more about you and your workshops, etc., where can they go?
They can either reach out to me on social networks. So I'm active on LinkedIn and on Twitter at Philip_Hritz, H-R-I-C, and Philip with an F. I guess people will read that on the title of the podcast. And I also have a homepage, philiphritz.com. So there I usually publish my blog posts. There you can find information about my workshops and generally what I'm up to. So that's probably the best place to reach me.
For this interview, I'm joined by Denis Leclerc.
Sorry.
I know you're in Belgium, but I think you're a Dutch Belgian, so I, you know, the pronunciation is always it's difficult.
Yeah, it is what it is.
You were speaking at We Are Developers last week. Now, your talk topic caught my eye because you were specifically looking at color blindness and color contrast and things like that in web design. Is that about right? About the summary of the talk? Okay.
It's partly design, but I shouldn't say only web design. Design in common.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And you work for Run DDWare.
DDWare, yes. DDWare is the technology stack of DDSoft. Right. Okay.
And what is that? You describe it. I think I could switch to in English just to get there. But I think you have a thread running through a lot of what you do, which is helping people access technology, I guess. That's kind of a thread. But just describe to me briefly what you do there.
So DDSoft is in Belgium a non-profit, and the thread is indeed in DDWare is the already announced part of DDSoft. We will have another part. And what we are doing in DDWare and that branch is really connecting the IT industry with the social industry with a big emphasis on accessibility.
Okay.
It's not only accessibility, but always the crossover of the social industry and the technology industry. By example, if a therapist or a body therapist practitioner contact us, we will make the websites. Of course, we love to build it accessible. But we also do research in accessibility and giving in-house trainings in companies about accessibility and inclusion. There is a crossover where we also teaching or learning and inspiring people how to collaborate with developers at your workforce on the autism spectrum. So it's DDSoft is all about, and DDWare, the IT branch of DDSoft, is all about the social impact of technology, if it's disabilities, if it's social jobs, if it's autism. So really humanizing the social effect and impact of software.
Okay.
That's what we are doing.
And so you talk about web design, coaching, training. What tends to be the biggest aspect of what you do?
Coaching and training.
Okay.
To be honest, we want this. It's nearly new our website, so we exist 7 years at this time, and we had some rebrandings. That's happened, that's life, that is businesses. And this rebranding with the new website is quite new. So if we are really doing in the past, our biggest is web design for let's say social businesses, but our goal is really to move and to push way more into trainings and workshops and companies. Just what I really love to do is learning and teaching people stuff. That's what I do as a speaker at conferences, in person or virtual. But that's what we really want to expand to in companies, and then not a session of an hour, but really half-day trainings, full-day trainings, even a wanted or appreciated two-day trainings. Mm-hmm. Next to that, we are really also having a big, we are putting a big emphasis on the IT coaching. Mm-hmm. It's really coaching is a methodology from the social industry that is used, by example, for people with disabilities, but also for people having mental situations. By example, there is burnout coaching. So people experience burnout and going into coaching to find a better job or in the same job that is fulfilled better to their needs. That's really coaching as a methodology in the social field. And we are seeing that it can help in IT. In some examples, let's say that kind of a massage therapist coming to you, see what they man the website and they don't know IT terms. They have a lot of people that's needed and search engine optimization is needed and accessibility is needed and you need to have Google Ads and Facebook Ads. But they don't see the root behind the trees or in the trees. And there, one thing is developing yourself is just their work. But to have more of the conversations with them to really define what they need, because they hear a lot of stuff. And I said, they really don't see the wood in between the trees. So they even don't know it anymore. And then the social methodology coaching really help to refine and to also learn them to be confident, because they don't, if they want to update their website, for example, change the price of a service. Most of them are also starting their business and they want to make quick adjustments. They don't want to call to us to change and maybe get an invoice. So they want to have some level of confidence in the website. And therefore, really non-IT people, there, the coaching methodology really helps learning implementation of technology. An example.
Okay. Let's now switch to the talk you did. What are some of the main issues with colorblindness and, I guess, vision in general, and using computers, using phones, using tablets? I know some platforms are better than others, but what are usually some of the biggest problems that many developers and designers overlook?
The biggest thing that we overlook is that this is stuff that you need to do yourself. The platforms are not really doing color contrast. The only thing that they are not doing is checking and giving an exclamation if it's not accessible. In general, you can test it. In general, people tend to not looking and imagine that they are other people, like for example, with disabilities. And as I said, it's not only color blindness. First of all, color blindness, 1 in 3 men, male people, because with women is way less, are colorblind. So 1 in 3 is not that little. And also, if you have a decreased sight, a small font, we are going smaller, a small font is even a little bit readable if the color contrast is bigger. If the color contrast is small, and what I see is that, first of all, most of the people don't know, have the knowledge about the color vision difficulties that we can have at color combination. So they don't ask for color combinations. And the other tendency is people like to have it. We have a tendency that we really want to have a color palette with less contrast. Because in the view, for a reason that I don't know at that time, in the view of a reason of the designers and developers, it looks nice if there is little contrast. But that makes it so much harder for a lot of people. And that's something that you even, if you really apply a little bit of logic into contrast is really how you differentiate A versus B, the foreground versus the background, so the text on the background. And if you really apply some logical thinking, should you ever put white on yellow?
No, not usually.
It happens way too much. Should you put white on light green? Say no, please.
Probably not. Yeah, I'm just trying to think in my
on
head.
On dark green, it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, yeah, sorry, carry on.
So it's a little bit of logical thinking, but next to this, no, the logical thinking, I think, is not always needed. It's only needed for the mindset to know it's important, and you will not know all color combinations. Yeah. But that's the thing. Half part of this talk, more than the half, the biggest part of my, first of all, I introduce you to the problem and that there are people really living with those disabilities with your color combinations in general. And then the biggest part of the talk, I really talk about three testing tools how you can test. And you can really test because the color contrast ratio, the ratio is the difference between the background and the foreground, let's say that's why color one and color two, that can be calculated to a mathematical number. And they are really testing tools against that number. And there are even standards published with the WCAG, the World Wide Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So it is, there are ratios that are working hard written, and they are test tools that you can test against the hard written ratios. That's the good thing.
Yeah, but so let's just, before we get to the testing tools, because I definitely know there are some. I mean, from my perspective of just having looked at some of the options, I can see that some operating systems do add things on top for contrast, for inverted, for changing font sizes, things like that. How much, you mentioned it a little bit already, but how much can application designers and developers rely on those to do some of the work for them? Or I guess if someone has committed kind of color contrast crimes, that they're not going to fix everything, but for the sort of middle ground, they may help. Is that kind of the case, or do they not really help as much as people think?
It's double. First of all, I appreciate you. I love the using of the term color contrast crimes because they are, I call it also accessibility crimes.
Yeah.
That's a difficult thing. First of all, they are tools for changing the contrast mode on each device. But the sad truth is we here as developers and also designers are really in the industry knowing all the stuff. You are not making those websites, application products for yourself and people like us. And please ask your family members and your, I always call the FFF, the friends, the family and the food. So the just a random 20 person on your Facebook profile. I don't say LinkedIn, I say Facebook or Instagram with this reason. And just ask them about what do they know and settings to change the stuff. So the majority don't know. Yeah. And the sad thing is, the sad truth is, this is also not learned to people with those difficulties. So I am not colorblind. I have a decreased sight. I never went to an eye specialist. I've been to eye specialists a lot. But I never went to an eye specialist saying, but do you know that you can adjust things on your computer? So the tools exist, but nearly nobody know that they are there. And unfortunately, this also includes people who will be have help with those tools. And just think about this. Just go to your, look into your close FFF, as I said, choose 20 of them, random, and ask them. I'm not sure if you will find one.
Before we get to the way people can improve things, can you give any examples of sites or applications that do it really well that people can use as a measure for what they should aim for?
I really love in general what Microsoft is doing for the public facing sites. I love it. They are really conscious about accessibility. And let's say just a company is working, has a chief accessibility officer, a seagull for accessibility, and most of the, and being public about it, are most of the time just doing great jobs because they know the knowledge about this. I love them. And then it's really, that's a bad thing. And that's maybe something bad about me if something you see frustrates you that it's really bad, you don't mind.
Mm.
But if you see the things that are good and doing what they should do, it is unnoticed.
Yeah,
so if you ask me, name five websites where you find it really bad, I can give you 10 instead of 5. But that's a blind spot of people.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's a pity thing, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it's fair enough.
It's fair enough.
Okay. And let's talk about then what people can use to see, to test for themselves, and preferably not just web, if there's also options for kind of native development, be that, you know, iOS, whatever it may be as well, because sometimes it's harder with those non-web tools. But what are some things that people can use to know what the problems are? Let's start with that, and then we'll go into what they need to do. But just we'll tell them there's problems in the first place.
The first thing that I should recommend is just playing with the settings to stimulate the disabilities, the vision difficulties, on your local device. And it doesn't matter. If it's your Windows, it will be in the settings, also with Android, also with iOS. So play with it and make it yourself hard. So a lot of tools you can set, stimulate, like I have this disability. Mm-hmm. Like a terminology of colorblindness is achromatopsia.
Yeah.
So just play with it. Photonopia. Okay. And see how much difficult it starts to be. Also, if you're using the WCAG contrast, color contrast checker and a plugin into your browser, you can also simulate this. And there are even filters that you can install on all your browsers and on your device. And then you see through the eyes of a person with difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And it's already get a little bit of funny to understand why it's needed to adjust some stuff.
And how are all of these common problems fixable? Or there are some that just there are no real solutions right now. And it's just a problem that we hope the industry will fix at a certain point.
There's a good thing and a bad thing about this.
Yeah.
The good thing, let's start with the good thing. It's all perfectly fixable. There are measures about, and it's, in fact, it's only about, it's everything you do, even your operating system as a design choice.
Yeah.
And most of the time, the operating systems are all accessible.
Yeah.
But it's just on the UIs that you are making, website UI, leaflet UI, also just software, let's call it, and all terminology is a design.
Mm.
And all the things, as I said, it's all about the color, contrast, and font sizes that you are using in your design, because each design is built, also the software tools that you are using. And the good thing is, it's measurable.
Yep.
There are guidelines and there are ratios. If you look to the WCAG standards on accessibility, there are official guidelines saying if you are reaching those guidelines, it's really, really good, and you will cover a lot of people, the biggest majority. So that's a good thing. There's a less good thing. People don't know it, and people don't look at the standards. So first of all, people don't know that they are there. And if you say it, you think about it just for a second, it's not a priority that the most of the people have, I know, to define and to test all the stuff. And that's a less good thing. So the problem that a lot of software and website is inaccessible is perfectly, on a technical way, perfectly solvable. 100%.
Okay. And I know that some accessibility guidelines are now, on certain sites and services, actually regulated by law. You have to have a certain level. I must admit my memory of that was based a few years back in Australia, not in Europe.
Yeah.
So let's take Europe as an example because we're both there now. Who has to follow accessibility guidelines by law and to what level?
In fact, by 2025, everybody need to have everybody who are giving services to public. So if you're selling to customers, you are giving services to public.
Yeah.
You need to have the WCAG compliant method AA. So WCAG, so the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, has three levels.
Yeah.
A, AA, and AAA. So you will need to have, and the WCAG also has versions. So the at this time, the most recent version is 2.2. So you need to have 2.2 AA. Mm-hmm. And theoretical, I say theoretical with reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In 2025, if you are having a customer finding difficulties, they can give a lawsuit to you, and they can even come to court. And but I say a lot of it can because mixed feelings.
Yeah. And we've seen this with, of course, other European regulations too.
Let's say if you have a country that their own official parts are not accessible, well, their courts punish you. Maybe. Wishful thinking.
As some of the things we've been talking about, are they, what level are they at in the WCAG guidelines?
So three levels. They have three levels. So they are saying,
no, for some of the color issues we've talked about.
I got all of them. Am I all covered? For example, I can explain this really simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's really simple. Level A is the least accessible. Level AAA is the most accessible.
Okay.
If you're going to, and the WCAG is not about only about color contrast, it's about everything for accessibility.
Okay.
And level A, they are saying color is not the only way of conveying information. Mm. So they don't talk about color contrast ratio. I give an example on color contrast, because that's the talk of today. That means color is not the only way of conveying information. If you have a hyperlink, it's good to have a different color, and my example also underlying. If you have, for example, a black text, and you put a hyperlink in it without an underline, because your designer find it ugly, an underline, and they only put it in green, and make it simple, then color is the only way of conveying information. So level A, they are saying, color is not the only way of conveying information, so that's not okay anymore. And then level AA works with the ratios that you need to have for regular text, small text, and logos. And then you have the AAA, does the same, but then the ratios are harder. Let's give you the official numbers of the ratios that you need to have, because they are... That's a good thing. It's all official and tangible. So, as I said, it's in all three. But the rules or the measures are harder the higher you are going to the A's. So let's see the official ratio that they are saying in WCAG 2.2. Level A is only saying color is not the only way. Double A saying everything need to be the ratio 4.5:1. Except larger text can be 3:1. And there are some exceptions that, and then, for example, if you're going to AAA, everything need to be 7:1. Except larger text 4.5:1. So it's just doubled.
What motivated you to turn this into a job as opposed to just something you were passionate about? Why did you want to take this so much further? This kind of topic of accessibility and computing access, et cetera, et cetera.
Myself, I am a person with autism, and I didn't find the way, let's say, in the regular workforce. And I am doing everything in a nonprofit, but not only TD, so not only my own nonprofit, because that's the best way for me to have my quality of life, and I have a fee from the government. And I started to work in 2012, and then daycare center specific for people with disabilities and also severe disabilities, like cognitive disabilities, like people with Down syndrome. And I really was sorry how many people are excluded in technology. And I am there working as a developer for custom tailored solutions for them. Really frustration if you're seeing how many people are falling, let's say, behind the tech boat. And also, and tech is becoming part of life. And also, my other thing, as I said, my eyes are not good. I'm not colorblind, but I have the queer sight. And if you really, as not colorblind people, seeing to... So I always had talks about accessibility. That's my passion since 2017, if I started as a conference speaker. But really the talk about, just about color contrast, to be honest, as a talk started from my own frustration. Mm. Yeah, and talks about starting from a frustration seems to be successful, I thought. Because as not colorblind, really the contrasts they are using, even official departments, that you are really need to concentrate to read. And then also a wave of new, let's say, influencers and startups, not in tech only, but also, let's say, dietitians, influencers, with a new product, I saw them using a lot of folders and leaflets that I'm saying, why? Why make it difficult for people? It's so simple to do it right.
I think there's probably an aspect where, you know, there's a lot of frameworks and tools that people use that probably start from a bad spot. But because people don't know that, they just use them, and so it propagates the problem.
It's not that bad, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
I really researched that.
Yeah, and especially with a lot more tools kind of created from, you know, the technical perspective of why it's good. And
by
the
example,
other stuff gets forgotten
to make
about,
it
yeah.
concrete, it is not okay that a tool, a real famous tool, a official tool that a lot of non-technical people use to design, it's a website, it starts with the C, I won't say more. It's really not okay that they even don't show you a warning that your things are not accessible. It's like they even don't inform you. It's not okay.
All right, I think that's a good spot to end on. It's not okay. And that was my interviews with Philip and Denny from We Are Developers way back in the summer of 2023. Took me a little bit of time to get to them. I am catching up, getting there slowly. But I hope you enjoyed them. Now, a few small things from me. As I've mentioned on the past few episodes, I'm still rethinking how I'm going to do some of my news and links shows, and I'm going to spend a little bit of the holiday season thinking about that. So for now, I'm just leaving that out, but I do have a few things I've been up to share with you. First, on the video front, I have the first of two, the second one hasn't been published yet, sponsored content with PixieBricks, a really interesting low-code platform that lets you add all sorts of automation and extra interface elements to web pages. And you can have a look what I get up to in the first video there, where I figure out how to connect GitHub issues to Trello and all sorts of weird things like that. And then I have a second video nestled amongst a couple of sort of random shorts where I look at actions for Obsidian, bringing Apple Shortcut to Obsidian, which is also a great little add-on tool to try and bring a little bit more macOS nativeness to a wonderful application. This is Obsidian, but it is not always very native. On the blog front, I also have a blog version of that actions for Obsidian video over on Medium. There's also a blog version I posted as a guest over on the Scoring Notes blog, which got a lot of comments from people in the industry, and I've been having a lot of conversations with people from very large software companies helping me figure out some of the problems I had, which has been quite an interesting process, and I will definitely have some follow-up content around that very soon. As we round down for the year, what else? I have a small game that I entered into the Buttonshire game competition, an 18-card game based on holidays. I will post links to that very soon once the competition is over, which is today, day of recording. And there will be possibly a few more things dripping out before the end of the year. As always, you can keep an eye on christianschiller.com. I am looking forward to a few days off, but there's one more week to go yet. And then just a few days off, but every little helps. So until then, I have been Christian Schiller. I hope you enjoyed the interviews. Thank you very much for joining me, and take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at christianschiller.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, Join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.